It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, we'll find out how the game of ping pong changed the face of international diplomacy and how the sport helped realign the balance of world power.
Before that, we take a look at net neutrality. Earlier this week, a U.S. appeals court struck down federal rules requiring broadband providers to treat all internet traffic equally.
And while that might sound a little wonky, some are saying this court decision could have the potential to change the future of the internet as we know it.
Joining us now to explain how this might affect internet users is Ed Wyatt. He's a reporter at the New York Times covering telecommunications and technology policy. Ed, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Good afternoon.
Well, we've been hearing the phrase net neutrality tossed around a lot over the years. Can you define it for us, please?
Right. Net neutrality simply means that all traffic has to be treated equally. There has to be a neutral policy toward any type of traffic carried on a broadband network. But there's another kind of more important phrase called common carrier. And if I can indulge you in a little bit of history, it'll help you understand this
Sure.
a little better. It goes back to the time of the railroad barons, and the government determined that the railroads were such an important part of commerce that they had to carry anything that someone wanted to ship by rail. Now, there were some restrictions. They didn't have to carry, say, if you wanted to ship a bomb, or they didn't have to carry so many passengers that there were passengers hanging off the roof. But in general, they had to carry anything that anybody wanted to ship at a neutral price, charging everybody the same for the same amount of shipping. As the telephone network developed, the government said that is a common carrier, too. Telephone companies, you have to, in order to provide telephone service, you have to carry all telephone traffic. As the internet started, all internet service was dial-up over telephone lines. And so the same thing, common carriage or net neutrality, if you will, applied to dial-up internet service. But by 2002, we had broadband. And what the FCC determined is that that broadband is not a common carrier. It's not the same as a telecommunications service, that it's something different, essentially an information service. There's some added value there. And so they said, we're going to classify broadband internet service differently, and it's not subject to these common carrier requirements. The operators of the network have some leeway in what they can do. Now, flash forward. The FCC in 2010 said we want to treat all networks equally, impose net neutrality. The court said yesterday you can't do that because essentially you're treating everything like a railroad or a telephone network, and that's not what it is.
So until a couple days ago, if my company, Robco, has a website and I want to pay Verizon or somebody extra to make Robco's.com go faster, I couldn't do that.
Right, under the FCC rules. And so Verizon challenged that, and they got the court to agree with them that that the network is not that kind of network, and it's not regulated that way, according to the FCC itself and the decision it made in 2002. Now, what the court said additionally is that the FCC does have some authority to write regulations governing the internet. And what exactly that authority is unclear. It can do things that help promote the economic value of the internet and that provide greater access and stimulate commerce. So there will be a lot of arguments over, if Netflix pays Verizon to download its movies faster to consumers, is that improving the economics of the internet, or is that blocking other sites that can't afford to pay?
Right. One of the big concerns, one of the big criticisms of this ruling and getting rid of net neutrality, right, is that the big guys can pay lots of money and make their stuff go faster. The new internet startups that have been such a focus of high-tech economic development can't compete on that playing field, so now they're at a built-in disadvantage from day one.
Right. And so, if you remember back in the mid-90s, there were all kinds of search engines that people used, Alta Vista, Yahoo, Ask Jeeves, and Google. And what people discovered was they liked using Google better. It provided better results. Google made a deal with AOL to kind of give it exclusivity. And as a result, Google grew into what it's grown into. But they didn't make a deal to block all other internet search engines. You still could get those on the internet.
So I know there's a lot of speculation. The FCC has to react, maybe even appeal this. But what are some of the scenarios for the people who are using the internet, the everyday consumer?
Well, nothing's going to change immediately in what you see. And what the new chairman of the FCC has said is that he wants to let companies experiment with these kind of things and see if there is consumer harm. And if there are some of these programs implemented where it's evident that there is harm to consumers or that consumers are being outright blocked from getting some services, then the FCC will intervene. But they don't want to upfront impose regulations. And so the average internet user is not going to see a lot different immediately, but this could have a big effect down the road.
Well, one harm you mentioned is maybe we don't get to see some of the services via our particular internet provider. Is there a thought that it might increase or maybe decrease what consumers pay for their broadband service, say?
Well, it certainly could. If Netflix decides we want to pay Verizon to get our movies through the pipeline faster, its profit margins are going to go down. So Netflix then may say, well, we're going to shift some of this cost to the paying customer. Now, if Verizon owned a movie studio or Comcast owns a movie studio, if they make it so that their movies download faster than movies from other movie studios, that could present a problem because it could be essentially giving an advantage to their own content.
Well, it sounds like that might be something that would move away from the FCC to the FTC, right? The Federal Trade Commission, if there's a worry that there are some kind of monopolistic practices. Is that something you see as maybe in the future?
Well, it's possible. The Justice Department ruled on the merger of Comcast and Universal NBC and actually imposed some short-term restrictions on that kind of thing. But it does hold the potential for monopoly power to develop and for these companies to either disadvantage consumers or not disclose adequately what they're doing.
I see a lot of interest in this from obviously the companies involved on either side of the issue, from certain internet advocates, but do you see a lot of public attention to the issue of net neutrality?
I don't, because it's a difficult concept to grasp.
Yeah.
As I try to explain it here, it just seems ever more difficult. most people don't care. Whether Netflix is paying Verizon to speed the movies. All they care is they turn on their TV, do they have to wait 2 minutes before a movie downloads? And if some of these deals solve that problem, consumers may not be too upset.
What's next in the legal system? Is this something that will likely end up at the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, from what the FCC chairman has said so far, it doesn't look like he's heavily leaning toward appealing the decision. Now, he said that we may appeal the decision, and they're still going over it. But it seems like they want to see how things work out, just see what products develop and what effect they have on consumers, and kind of go on a case-by-case basis. I think that one possibility is the FCC could go back itself or go to Congress and say, we want to change our mind. That internet service is a common carrier. It is a utility like a telephone and has to be regulated like that. If they do that or they get Congress to do that, then they could impose some of these neutrality rules.
Ed, thanks a lot for clearing these issues up for us.
I'm not sure I did.
Well, for me anyway. I think I know more now. Ed Wyatt was with us. He's a reporter at the New York Times. He covers telecommunications and technology policy.
Coming up next, we'll take a look at how a game of ping pong changed the face of diplomacy.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later this hour, we'll hear how the Wisconsin whooping cranes arrived in Florida last week. We'll catch up on how they're faring and what it means for crane conservation.
But first, when you think of international diplomacy, two words you might not think of are ping and pong. But our guest today traces the surprising history that links table tennis and international relations.
Nicholas Griffin says the game of ping pong has a long history of political intrigue. His new book is called Ping Pong Diplomacy, The Secret History Behind the Game That Changed the World. Nicholas, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, ping pong doesn't always seem like a sport of huge consequences when you compare it with some other high-profile games, but according to you, it does have an incredibly rich political history. Where did the idea to use ping pong as a political tool come from?
It actually came from the man who actually sat down and wrote the rules to the game. It had had this sort of brief burst of popularity in the late 19th century, but then it faded and died until this very wealthy young aristocrat came along and sat down and wrote the rules to the game. But what no one knew was that he was, the same year he wrote the rules to the game, he started working for the Soviet Union secretly as a spy and actually worked for them in one form or another all the way through the rest of his life.
It seems like a pretty revolutionary idea. So how did he get from, you know, being a spy to thinking, hey, this ping pong thing, I could do something with this?
Well, the first part of the Soviet Union who sort of had him on the payroll, not that he actually, that's not fair because he wasn't actually paid, but it was called the Comintern, which is short for the Communist International. And their mandate was to sort of impregnate Western culture with communist ideas and in any way, shape or form. So they tried to use absolutely everything. He was a filmmaker as well. He actually produced all of Alfred Hitchcock's early spy movies, not that Hitchcock knew he was a spy, but sport was another obvious sort of cultural medium through which he could contact a very large group of people.
So he could reach large groups of people with ping pong, but it's still, you know, people playing table tennis together. What's incendiary or revolutionary about introducing ping pong?
Well, the point for him was to then create an international table tennis federation, which he could start use to tying countries together around the world who didn't necessarily have diplomatic relations. Now, obvious moments would be such as the Iron Curtain. He could move in and out behind the Iron Curtain without any questions being asked. That meant he could certainly, being a courier wasn't an issue, taking meetings all over the place wasn't an issue. And then it sort of got more and more serious once he got the Chinese involved.
Did he actually have a love of the game alongside all of the political intrigue?
Yeah, no, his love of the game goes right the way back to a table he made his father buy in their vast mansion in Kensington, London, back in sort of around 1914. His ping pong was as one of his deep loves right up there alongside communism.
It's an unusual match, isn't it? And it did find a home in China. Why did it catch on so easily there?
Well, the good thing for this man, the Honorable Ivor Montague, was that it was fertile ground. So when he took the game and offered it to Mao and Premier Zhou Enlai in 1950, within 3 weeks of the foundation of the People's Republic of China, it turned out they both already loved the game. They used to play during bombing raids of Chiang Kai-shek on sort of the communist enclave in Yan'an.
Wow.
Zhou Enlai and Chairman Mao used to sit in a cave together playing a game of ping pong.
Playing ping pong. That's a surreal thought.
I know. But when he arrives in 1950 and offers it to them, he's already offered to many countries, including the Soviet Union, who are not quite that enthused as the idea of ping pong as a national sport. But in China, they leap on it.
And so it took root there, and it became something that was played across the nation, and they began to pride themselves on ping pong, it sounds like. How did it catch on?
Well, the good news is if you're the Chinese government and you want to do something top-down, the whole state structure was set up that way. So they copied a lot of the Soviet structures, and it was, you know, very much in order from above. So, you know, they'd start looking for players in school playgrounds, then you'd be sent to sort of night school for ping pong, then it would be a sort of sports school for ping pong, then you'd be picked up by your city team, and then you'd be scooped up by the national team. So it was all highly structured.
Wow, that's fascinating.
But they had these vast competitions, you know, trying to get millions of people involved, because the idea was that not that they wanted to play the sport, but they wanted to win an international competition for the first time and show that modern China was strong. Now, ping pong was an odd way to do it, but they knew they had a very good friend in Ivan Montague, and they'd be protected, whereas they knew that things like the Olympics and the Soccer's World Cup were very much driven by Western democracies who they still didn't trust.
Well, it's interesting that they latched onto ping pong in a way because, you know, ping pong gets dismissed a lot of the time as being, you know, sort of table tennis light and tennis light, I should say. And, you know, some people think, what is there to it? It's kind of a kid's game, but you can get pretty virtuosic on it.
Yeah. No, I mean, it doesn't carry a lot of weight in the rest of the world. That's totally fair to say. But, you know, that ends up being to China's strength when we get a little deeper into this story, the fact that no one else was really paying attention to it. But there, it was sort of just this first way for them to get their foot on this sort of, for what they considered international respect, and to show that they were no longer, you know, the sick man of China, which is how they'd been painted since the 1840s.
So at one point in 1961, ping pong was more than a recreation or a point of national pride. It was those things too, in a way, but it was also used to cover up a horrible famine where millions of people died. Can you tell us how ping pong was used in China then?
Yeah, I mean, you get this moment called the Great Leap Forward in the late 50s in China. And the idea here is that China's going to industrialize super rapidly, they're going to overtake Great Britain steel production. They're going to overtake American grain production. But they have some very bad ideas that this is based on. One of those is the close planting of seeds, that seeds are like good communists, and if you put a whole lot together, they'll help each other grow. Now, of course, anyone who's ever done any farming knows that seeds will fight just like animals will, and everyone's fighting for light and water, and that they'll all die. So you have these horrible crop failures across China, along with several other factors, and it combines to make this incredible famine. And that famine kills, depending on Chinese statistics, say 17 million. The latest statistics done by a professor in Hong Kong say 44 million. The numbers are just extraordinary. And during that time, Ivan Montague, the head of the International Table Tennis Federation, the Soviet agent, brings them this sort of one ray of hope, and that's, would China like to host the World Table Tennis Championship in 1961? So coming towards the end of the famine here, they have this chance for this propaganda show to show that everything is absolutely fine in China. So they bring in foreign players, foreign officials, foreign journalists, and they set up this sort of Potemkin village situation where they get everybody in and out without a single crumb of knowledge of what's really happening in China leaking out of the country.
So it works. The ping pong ruse works.
It worked. It was so sort of benign in a way, which was what was so wonderful, and what the Chinese began to realize that it's rather a disarming sport. How on earth are you going to think of ping pong as political? And yet it was.
And the next big event that you profile, they'd already used it to great success in that case, but in 1971, 10 years later, it gets used again in another high-stakes gambit between the U.S. and China, who are having trouble coming together. How did ping pong enter into the picture there?
Well, you had this fascinating moment where it looks like the leadership of both respective countries have sort of figured out how to communicate alone. So in other words, Nixon and Kissinger have reached out without the State Department's knowledge, and Mao and Zhou Enlai have reached out without anyone else's interference. And you get this very slow motion back channel opening up in which handwritten notes are sent around the world in diplomatic pouches. And it's going very slowly, but it's pretty steady until the American side misses a grand signal. And that signal was that Chairman Mao put a left-wing American journalist standing on his right during a parade. Now, we missed that. We didn't understand that was part of this game that we were playing. So that meant that we didn't respond. So suddenly you had this chasm opening up again. And it had been 22 years since any serious conversation had gone on. So the Chinese needed to come up with a statement so obvious, so political, that everyone was going to get it. And the method they chose was this game of ping pong.
And just introduce us to the match a little bit. And it got some news coming up in about 30 seconds. What were those first moments like?
The whole thing swirls around this relationship of two young men. One is an American hippie called Glenn Cowan, and the other is the best player in the world, a three-time world champion called Chuang Tse-Tung, and they're very, very different characters.
We're talking right now with Nicholas Griffin. He's the author of Ping Pong Diplomacy, The Secret History Behind the Game That Changed the World. And we're hearing right now the story of the 1971 match that brought the U.S. and China together.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you think sports in general can provide the glue, as ping pong did, to bring nations together? Do you remember that 1971 match? Did you pay attention? Did it mean something to you? What do you think of using sports to a political end? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Nicholas Griffin. He's the author of Ping Pong Diplomacy, The Secret History Behind the Game That Changed the World. We're hearing the story of the 1971 match that brought the U.S. and China together.
And maybe you want to join the conversation. We'd like to hear from you. Do you remember that game? Did it grab your attention? Did you pick up ping pong, table tennis, after it got that worldwide recognition in that U.S.-China diplomatic event? You can call or with your questions at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Nicholas, let's go back to that match in 1971. It took place in China, and the U.S. folks went over there. What was the scene like when they arrived?
They were really the first big group of any consequence to enter Americans to enter China in 22 years. So most, when you talk to most of the players, many compared it to sort of stepping onto the surface of the moon. So little was known about China at that time. A lot of the people who studied it in the State Department compared it more to astrophysics to diplomacy. So everything was new, and everything was very strange. And for instance, the first big game, they're in the largest ping pong stadium in the world. It holds somewhere between 18 and 20,000 people, bigger than Madison Square Garden when it's playing a basketball game. But the big difference for these American players, who've rarely played in front of even 500 people, is that every single member of that crowd happens to be a member of the People's Liberation Army, all wearing the same thing. I mean, talk about a culture shock.
And the American star that you were talking about, he was a character. Tell a little bit about what it was like for him as he kind of went around in China and met people.
Yeah, he was certainly the first hippie ever to enter China. So any wonders with his sort of purple bell-bottom trousers and his yellow floppy hat and this white T-shirt with covered in peace signs saying, "Let it be." He's actually having a wonderful time because he's just decided to be himself. And, of course, the press members who've been allowed to go suddenly realize that this is the man to sort of build the story around. So you get this sort of bizarre symbiotic relationship between Glenn Cowan and the press, where it's very obvious that he's going to be the one they turn to because it's just a great story, an American hippie in communist China during the Cultural Revolution. It's just too good.
And it sounds like he made no secret of the fact that he didn't, mind getting high now and then, and there were some surreal moments in the media.
Yeah. It turns out, he'd promised that he'd sort of thrown his stash away before he crossed the border, but apparently he hadn't. He took it in with him and was wandering around high as a kite half the time. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing to think of. I mean, most of the people on that team were feeling this pressure of being turned from sort of athletes into sort of accidental diplomats overnight. And yet here he is, cool as a cucumber, just doing his thing as if he was back in his hometown of Los Angeles.
So what was that championship match like? How did the American game stack up against the Chinese game?
Well, the the wonderful thing with the Chinese is they were by far the best team in the world, and the Americans, I think, finished that year ranked 28th. So they were in control of everything.
So it wasn't the match of the century.
It was not the match of the century, but the Chinese made it exciting. They threw a few games here and a few games there, and they got. But it's not as if they could get the crowd going, because the crowd were made up of soldiers. So the crowd got going when the lights flashed to tell the crowd to get going. it was a very, very controlled atmosphere. But, the really extraordinary thing, which the American players didn't know at the time, was how this was playing outside of China. Of course, inside of China, it's state-controlled press. It was sort of kept relatively quiet. But this thing spread like wildfire around the world. And Glenn Cowan was front-page news from the day he walked across and entered into China.
And what did that change for America and China?
It changed everything. I mean, the extraordinary thing was the first polls that were taken a couple of weeks after the Americans came back from China. Previously, the feeling of the American public was pretty much anti-China, anti-communist, as it had been for a long time. And yet, within 2 weeks, you've got that poll, which now reveals a majority of Americans favor communist China being accepted into the UN, which then, of course, goes ahead and happens that year. And what this maneuver of, this highly meticulous strategy in China of creating this sort of ping-pong moment, it's provided this enormous political breathing space for both Kissinger and Nixon and Mao and Zhou Enlai to take their time and to sort of get things organized. And that leads to Henry Kissinger appearing on a secret mission that July in Beijing, and then the president himself. Nixon rolls into town in February of the next year, in 72.
So they really opened the floodgates in a way.
They did. And actually, if you look at it, I mean, one of the early things you learn about negotiating in the arena of international relations is that, the three most important things are location, location, location. And here the Chinese, who are by no means a strong nation at that time, the most populous nation, but not by far from the strongest, they have managed to get ping-pong diplomacy to happen in Beijing. They've managed to persuade Kissinger, who was willing to meet anywhere, to come to Beijing. And they've managed to convince President Nixon to come to Beijing. And that, in Beijing, is where they create the Shanghai Communique, which is the first new document in this new relationship.
Do you think this would have worked if it were a different sport? I'm imagining, for instance, American football. If they'd invited Americans to come over and play football, I can't imagine the American public would have been so kindly disposed to be trounced at football in China, and that it would have been this moment of acceptance. What is it about ping pong that opened the door?
I think it played perfectly from both sides. So to the Chinese, it let them feel as if they were always going to be the better team. They were in this position of power. They could throw games. The Chinese public would understand that. And from the American side, it was, ping pong is this benign sport that supposedly belongs in basements and fraternity houses. So to us, it totally humanized the Chinese. It's like, you know what? These guys aren't sort of eating babies for breakfast. They're ping pong players, just like us. What could be more harmless?
But they were incredible ping pong players. I've seen some shots of the Chinese players from that game, and it doesn't look like, a fluffy sport. It looks like these guys are real athletes.
Oh, no. I mean, it was taken tremendously seriously over there. These guys were, they had the same regimen every day. They were lifting weights, swimming, marching through snow. I mean, you name it. It was
for ping pong.
For ping pong. I mean, it seems preposterous, but that's how seriously it was taken over there.
And so what is the legacy of that moment? Has it been used again? And is it something that really deserves to go down in the annals of diplomatic history?
I mean, I think it does, because it's just this absolutely unique moment. I think itself, the problem with it, I think, is that it sets a false precedent in that you have people wanting to check out basketball diplomacy and wrestling diplomacy, and all these other things have been tried. But here you had something very peculiar going on, and that was that just before ping pong diplomacy takes place, you have this political goodwill forming out of the blue, and it's secret, so nobody knows it's happening. It's not covered by any press or newspaper. This framework that Nixon and Mao are creating between them, so the ping pong diplomacy is interpreted absolutely correctly and timed perfectly and very much warmly accepted in the White House. I mean, it shocked the White House. They were very surprised when it came along. Kissinger was a little worried that it was going to upset all his back channel shenanigans. But Nixon, within 24 hours, his favorite question to anyone entering the White House is, have you learned to play ping pong yet? He got it immediately.
Wow. And then that's a picture, too, Nixon playing ping pong. I can't do it. So did a lot of people want to play ping pong after this happened? Did it take off?
Yeah, it had a brief burst of popularity, and unfortunately for Glenn Cowan, the American hippie, he thought that he was going to ride that ping pong ball to fame and riches. And, you know, everything was wonderful for about a month, and he's on every chat show across America. He's with Johnny Carson, you name it, he's doing it. But then, of course, the sort of bubble bursts and ping pong returns to the basement, and poor Glenn Cowan is sort of set adrift.
Well, Nicholas, thank you so much for joining us. It's a great story.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
That was Nicholas Griffin. He's a journalist and the author of the book Ping Pong Diplomacy, The Secret History Behind the Game That Changed the World.
That really was an interesting story. I learned cool stuff on this show. That's awesome. What a good job we have.
Thanks for listening, Rob.
Glad to listen. Hey, coming up, we're going to hear how Wisconsin whooping cranes are faring after their migration to Florida. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll get an update on the migration of the whooping crane population.
But first, it's time for a Wisconsin life. In recent years, sewing has reemerged as a popular hobby thanks to the do-it-yourself movement. One Wisconsin woman has turned her love of sewing into a mission to distribute sewing machines to communities in distress from natural disasters or poverty. She believes that sewing can heal.
My name is Margaret Jankowski. And I founded the Sewing Machine Project in 2005 as a response to the tsunami in Southeast Asia. And read an article about a woman who had lost her sewing machine in that storm. And it didn't even occur to me that it wouldn't work. I just decided that it was time to start collecting sewing machines and trying to get them over there to people who'd lost their machines. To me, a sewing machine is a tool that not only gives somebody the ability to save money, it gives people the opportunity to also make money, and it's just a way to create. And to me, people who have been through poverty or natural disasters or, you know, any number of things need any possible way to find a way to heal. We're in a Sunday school classroom at a church. All around us are sewing machines. Everywhere you look, there are some on shelves and there are mostly on the floor. The ones that are on the shelves have been inventoried, but the ones that are on the floor, and there are at least 100, I'd say, on the floor, are waiting to be looked at by volunteers, and that'll happen in a few weeks. We've shipped machines to 8 different countries, and then several hundred within the United States, and then we've also donated machines locally. We have worked with Bhutanese refugees here in town in Madison, and we have worked with the Hispanic population, and now we're working with Hmong women. And up in northern Wisconsin, there's a group that's using the machines to work with women from Somalia. Not only do we offer these machines, we offer them away a sense of community because they come together to learn. When people sew together, it's like they start talking about the other parts of their lives and sharing stories, and so there's a real sense of community about it. We do this pay it forward aspect. Every time somebody gets a sewing machine, we ask them to pay it forward somehow, usually using that sewing machine in their community. In New Orleans, people would share their sewing machine, or they'd make something for someone else, or they'd teach someone to sew. Up here at our local classes, people make fleece hats for homeless clients that come into the shelter, or all different things. And I really, really believe that sending the message that every single person has the ability and the power and the responsibility to mend their own community is really important now more than ever. I think that everybody needs to know that, and I think that people often feel like they have nothing to give, and everybody does. And so we send that message along with our machines.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Now a look at the ongoing effort to restore the endangered whooping crane. Wisconsin is a big part of that effort, and a group of the cranes completed their migration from Wisconsin to Florida last week.
To bring us up to date on the crane effort, we've got Anne Lacey, Crane Research Coordinator for the International Crane Foundation based in Baraboo. Anne, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you.
So tell us about these cranes who just got to Florida. How did they find their way there, and how many were there?
They were helped. Yeah, there's eight whooping cranes that are now foraging around in the muck in the wonderful St. Mark's National Wildlife Refuge, and that's in the Florida Panhandle. And so that is the last of the cohort of 2013 birds that finished the fall migration. So even though it's January, we'll still call that a fall southward migration. And so they join five direct autumn release birds, and that's another method that we use to raise cranes and put them out into the wild, also raised in costume, like the birds that follow the ultralight down from Wisconsin. But these birds, they're raised in Horicon National Wildlife Refuge, and they are released out into their own to follow older birds, be it whooping cranes or sandhill cranes. And there's also two parent-reared birds out there that are wintering in the eastern flyway. And these birds are raised at Patuxent National Wildlife Refuge by older birds. And these are real whooping cranes, not people in costume. And they were shipped to Wisconsin and released in Nisida National Wildlife Refuge. And then they migrated on their own as well. So that's kind of a broad overview of all the different types of ways that we're raising birds to put out there in the landscape.
So the ones that just arrived, you mentioned, were led there by ultralight. How many times do they have to make that journey with that guidance before they start doing it on their own?
Just once.
Just once.
They can make that map in their head just once, just like birds that follow their parents. They learn that route, learn safe places to roost, how to find food. And by the time they get down to the winters, often they will follow their parents back, even on the northward migration. But then they're kicked out because they have to start nesting again, the adults. And so it just takes that once for them to learn that map. And then they're on their own.
How was the ultralight piloted? I remember, I feel like it used to be sort of someone who looked like they were in a hang glider or something. I imagine it's a little different now.
It's still the same. They have upgraded. They have to meet FAA regulations to fly them. But it is essentially a mechanized hang glider. They have a fan on the back. And so they have very limited requirements for their flight. So it's not like a normal migration flight where birds find thermals and can fly all day. So they need calm air or not very strong northward wind for the southward migration. But it's piloted by people, and they are in costume. So it's a big undertaking for those pilots to get in there and in full costume, full helmet and face mask, to pilot those birds down to Florida.
Looking back at the big picture, how close were whooping cranes to extinction?
Close. We now have 109 birds in the eastern population, and they join 400 or so in the extant population that flies between Canada and Texas. And all of those birds came from the lowest of that population was 15 birds.
Mm.
So that's quite the relatedness. You know, when we talk genetic variability in this population, it's pretty low. So we're doing our best to increase that as well.
What are some of the remaining challenges with the restoration effort?
Oh, beginning at the beginning, there are still a lot of challenges. We've learned so much, and every year we reassess and refine as needed. But we begin with looking at the genetics. Do we have the best genetic variability that we can out there? And we use artificial insemination. We use natural pairs. We use eggs that we salvage from the wild to make sure that we have enough birds to take part in all of these different raising techniques. We try to make sure that they're making the right choices on the landscape. If they are injured, we try to fix them up and put them back out there. We try to see what is harming them on their nests. nests, if they're being driven off their nests. We try to make sure that they're safe along the flyway. There's a lot of challenges, but every year, like I say, we learn more, we refine, we educate. It's an ongoing process, even after 13 years.
Thinking about animals driven toward extinction or even into extinction in this country, usually the two factors I hear about are overhunting, like in the case of the passenger pigeon, or a habitat loss. How did those two factor in?
It was probably a little bit of both. Historically, they believe that there were not that many whooping cranes on the landscape. There were always, it's a relative term, but pretty sparse, especially as compared to sandhill cranes, the other native species of crane that we have in North America. So the few that they took out by hunting really affected the population, because these birds are long-lived, but they're not very productive. You know, one or two eggs, maybe one chick every other year that would fledge and then be able to join that breeding population eventually. Habitat loss is a big one. These birds rely on wetlands, and we know what the history of wetlands is in the country, especially in the central prey pothole region where a lot of whooping cranes nested. So that's probably why when they finally found the breeding area of the extant population of whooping cranes way up in the northern territories of Canada, it was way out of the way. They were kind of driven back to that, and so now we're trying to put them back into a landscape where we think they can make it. But again, and here in Wisconsin, we know how much the landscape has changed since European settlement, and we hope that it's still adequate to support these birds. We really don't know.
Now, here in Wisconsin, I think a lot of us know what sandhill cranes look like. We see them, you know, on the roadsides. You can get pretty close to them sometimes, yeah, at state parks, for instance. What does a whooper look like?
So if you picture a sandhill crane, very long neck, long legs, gray feathers. A whooping crane is bright lily-white feathers and a measure taller, maybe 5 to 6 inches taller than a sandhill crane, and it has that same red mark on the head and a black mask. But when it's flying, you see the black primary feathers, and so there's that very much that contrast to the black and white, whereas the sandhill just has that kind of darker gray primary flight feathers. But they both have that distinctive red head also, on that long, extended neck when they fly.
That's what they look like. I think we have a sample of what they sound like. Let's give a listen to a whooping crane. So hence the name. That's the whoop sound of the whooping crane,
Ann? That's an alarm call. So a pair of birds that might sense something wrong in their territory. Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask you what a non-alarmed call sounds like, but I don't want to put you on the spot.
I can do a broop from a sandhill, but I can't do a whooping crane very well. But we do, on our website, we do have calls of many of the cranes in our species guide on our savingcranes.org.
So we've got this gang down in Florida. When will they make an appearance back here in Wisconsin? It's a long trip.
Yeah, and they birds know when that trip back needs to start. And it's a combination of the temperatures increasing, southerly winds becoming more frequent, and day length that triggers the hormones in their head to start that migration back north. And it's usually the end of March, beginning of April. These are younger birds, so there's not that drive to come back to breed, but they will come back and they will follow pretty closely that path that they followed, whether it be ultralight or one that they went through on their own following other birds, like sandhills, for the other younger birds. But they will meander their way back and hopefully come back to that spot that they were raised at in Wisconsin. And by April, they all should be back.
Ann, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity.
That was Ann Lacy, Crane Research Coordinator for the International Crane Foundation.
Up next, why failure can help us succeed. Our guest message, fail fast and fail often. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.